From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscoane. Terry Gross is on vacation. The water is receding on Mary Fricke's Missouri farm, but most of the crops are gone. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Mary Fricke. Her book about life on her hog farm was just getting published when the floodwaters rushed in. She'll tell us about farm life before and after the flood. Also, a talk with film director Bill Duke. He directed A Rage in Harlem and Deep Cover, and most recently, The Cemetery Club. And Maureen Carrigan throws a nod to Dorothy Parker as she reviews The Bridges of Madison County by Robert James Waller. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Frank Stacio. President Clinton has officially launched his campaign for overhauling the nation's health care system. The president spoke to the nation's governors in Tulsa, Oklahoma, to offer some details on the plan he'll present to Congress next month. Bruce Dorton of member station KWGS reports.
The president's speech was the first shot to build support for a massive overhauling of the nation's health care system. He says his plan will guarantee universal access and says it will include incentives for staying well and against overutilizing health services. In addressing the concerns of small businesses that worry about the cost, the president said health care reform should have a positive effect.
I believe that health care reform will boost job creation in the private sector if it is done right. I believe it will offer a level playing field to all those small employers who are covering their employees right now and paying too much for it.
The president also told the governors fixing the health care system won't happen without a bipartisan effort, and he's calling on the nation's governors to get united behind his plan. For National Public Radio, I'm Bruce Dorton in Tulsa.
Bosnia's warring factions agreed in principle today to demilitarize Sarajevo and place the city under temporary UN administration. A UN spokesman said the tentative agreement would cover a large area around the capital, including strategic hills and suburbs, from which Serbs have shelled the city for 16 months. In Washington, the U.S. declared the withdrawal of troops from the two mountains had not ended the strangulation of Sarajevo. The U.S. and its NATO allies are ready to strike Serb positions if Sarajevo's siege is not ended. Heavy rain continues to pound parts of the Midwest. In northeastern Iowa, flash flooding has forced hundreds more people from their homes. Mark Moran of member station WOI reports from Des Moines.
The flooding that is happening here now is different from what the area saw last month. Instead of rivers and streams rising slowly, State Emergency Division spokesman Jerry Ostendorf says tributaries that feed the Mississippi are flash flooding, rising and falling very quickly.
The area impacted is going to be, I think, of course, smaller than what we've seen previously. But I think what we're going to see are greater extensive damage.
Nearly a foot of rain has fallen in some parts of the state, which is more than already swollen tributaries can keep up with. Ostendorf says the flash floods have washed out several bridges around the state, adding to the damage caused by record flooding last month. Volunteers and city officials are sandbagging again in Ames, which is in central Iowa. There, the Squaw Creek is expected to cover a busy road by tonight. For National Public Radio, this is Mark Moran in Des Moines.
Tropical Storm Cindy has been downgraded to a tropical depression, but not before drenching the Dominican Republic with heavy rain. Forecasters expected up to 10 inches of rain to fall on parts of the Dominican Republic, prompting fears of flash flooding and mudslides. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average rose more than 9 points. This is NPR News. In Detroit, a judge has reached a verdict in the trial of one of three white police officers accused in the beating of a black man last November. But that verdict won't be revealed until the jury deliberations involving the other two officers are complete. NPR's Don Gagne reports.
Robert Lesnau, facing a charge of felonious assault in the beating death of Malice Green, waived his right to a jury, choosing a bench trial instead. And today, just moments after attorneys concluded closing arguments, Judge George Crockett III announced that he had reached a verdict in the case. That verdict has been sealed, however. While the two juries, which are separately considering evidence against officers Larry Nevers and Walter Budson, continue their work. They are now in their third day of deliberations. At the start of the trial, the judge announced that he would release all of the verdicts simultaneously. Nevers and Budson face the most serious charges. Each is accused of second-degree murder, which carries a possible life sentence. All of the officers have been fired from their jobs. This is Don Gagne in Detroit.
A federal judge today refused to grant political asylum to Sheikh Omar Abdelrahman. Abdelrahman, who has ties to many of those charged in the bombing of the World Trade Center and the alleged plot to blow up other New York landmarks, had appealed the deportation order by the Immigration and Naturalization Service. A United Nations envoy said today the United Nations plans a $30 million appeal for aid to rebuild South Lebanon after a series of Israeli attacks last month. According to envoy Jan Eliasson, nearly all of the 300,000 villagers displaced by the fighting had returned. Eliasson said Lebanon needed the aid for both humanitarian reasons and to build stability. A new study made public today says smokers who puff low-tar and low-nicotine cigarettes are no better off than those who smoke brands with higher levels of the two chemicals. The study to be published in this month's American Review of Respiratory Disease found that carbon dioxide and cotine levels were barely distinguishable between the two brands. I'm Frank Stacio, NPR in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. When Dennis Fricke proposed to my guest, she figured she was marrying a farmer, not his farm. But she soon discovered, after droughts and floods and early frosts and plant and animal diseases, that it's a package deal. When you marry a farmer, you get the farm too. Mary Elizabeth Fricke lives on a farm just outside of Herman, Missouri. There, she and her husband farm some 400 acres and raise hogs. In spite of the long hours and the ongoing responsibilities of the farm, Mary Fricke manages to find time to write, something she's been doing since she was a young girl. Her first book has just been published about her life on their farm, and it's entitled Dino, Godzilla, and the Pigs. Mary Fricke has always lived within 10 miles of the Missouri River. She has watched the river rise and fall, but never has she seen the amount of devastation that this year's floods have caused.
It's curious because right now we are 4 miles from the river, and we're in the hills. And in our immediate area, it's kind of hard to believe that there's a flood going on less than, 5 miles away from us. But when you get into Herman, which is, right on the edge of the river, you don't even get into town before the stench and the well, everything is just brown. I mean, there is no green in Herman in the lower, along the Friend Creek.
What does it smell like? What does it smell like?
Something that's been in the refrigerator for about 2 months that you forgot to take out.
The whole area smells like that?
Oh, yeah. The stench is, somebody told me it smelled like death. And I said, yeah. Because there is no, the foliage, even the trees have an odd color. To a certain point, where they sit in water for days, there is no grass, no flowers. I mean, the city park is along Friend Creek, and it's usually this time of year green and lush, and people are playing around in there, and it's mud and just brown and ugly. I mean, even there's nothing there anymore.
What impact has the flood had on your farm, and have you and your husband been able to plant crops?
Well, the crops, the majority of the crops that we had planted were flooded. We have lost approximately 85% of what we had, and that includes the crops that were planted and those who weren't. That's a land percentage.
Is that mostly corn?
Yeah, we hadn't really gotten into the beans. I mean, we were so late with corn, there was so much rain that it was the middle of May before we even began to plant corn. And we had gotten in a couple hundred acres, and we have lost all but 50 or 60 acres of that, I guess. And most of what we have is here along the road where we live, the rest of it. And there is just a little on high ground, maybe. Well, I'm going to take that back. I think there's about 50 acres along the high ground, and then what we have here, which would be another, we have about 100, I guess. But that was all we got planted, as opposed to planting like 400.
Now, it's mid-August, and let's say the weather clears up and you have a good dry spell into the fall. Can you plant anything? Is there enough time?
Wheat. It's too late for anything else.
Now, you mentioned that you haven't been able to plant about 85% of your crops. What are you going to do this winter? What are you going to do about cash?
Well, we are hoping that we have enough stored. which we do have a small bit, a very small bit stored from last year. And we have enough, we do have that 100 acres yet. And we're hoping that that will help us be able to feed the hogs, you know, without having, you know, and be able to keep them until, you know, they will sell at a fairly decent price. Then we will be able to live off the hogs. It'll still be a lean year. You know, we'll have to really, you know, cut back because we have, you know, a lot of land and operating expenses, but, and they must be paid. But, you know, so everything else will be cut back.
Now, President Clinton just signed a multi-billion dollar relief bill. How will that affect you?
Not as much as what he would hope, because this kind of devastation is so broad that by the time that money is distributed, it won't, no one is really going to get that much. You know, it's just, it's, the destruction is too big. I don't think that really, I don't think the United States could afford, you know, to hand over the kind of money it's going to take to repair this.
Do you know how much it would take to repair your farm?
Oh, well, no, at this point, because most of our land has still got water on it. We really have not been able to get out there and see. You know, for us, it's cleanup. It's not, you know, the repair of buildings and machinery or anything. We were lucky in that respect. You know, in living miles away from the edge of the river, all we had was the farmland. And we're also lucky in the fact that a lot of the land that we rent is, that we farm is rented area. So we're going to have help from the landlords. But most of that land is still underwater or simply too muddy to get out in there to figure out just what we're going to have to do. Because, you know, with the river comes trash. You know, every imaginable kind of trash there is comes down the river in a flood. And then when the water goes away, that trash is left behind. So we may go out there in the field sometime next spring and find ourselves trying to dig up a piece of an old car out in the middle of the field. I know right now, just from driving down the roads, we can look out there and we can see logs and pieces, you know, from trees, these big, huge chunks that it's going to take the strength of a tractor to pull out of the field, you know, that were never there before. You have torn down fences, so we're going to be finding barbed wire and things like that out in the middle of the fields that were never there before.
Could you describe for us, even as you leave your farm and you travel around Herman, Missouri, what the road conditions are like, what you see other farmers having to deal with?
Well, the roads really are the largest problem. Many of our roads have been washed out. Major highways have had the pavement just destroyed. The pavement is gone, and we're just across the river on 19. They have dumped truckload after truckload after truckload of rock into a hole, or I think there are several holes there actually, but at one point they said that the rock actually disappeared. They didn't know where, that the hole was so deep that they could not see where it went. And as you drive down the road, you know, you see this driving is very hard because the water has washed over the road. It has washed ruts in the road, and it has washed, like, churned, literally, so that the small gravel isn't really on top anymore. You get the rocks that are underneath, if they're there. If they're not there, you've got big holes that you have to either dodge or get through very carefully.
Are there levees around?
Yeah, but the majority of the levees have broken. And when the levee breaks, the force of the water coming through is so tremendous. It's like, I keep thinking Niagara Falls, but I imagine, you know, the force, it's comparable to that, maybe even worse. It's just, it's like a tidal wave just comes in, and there is destruction. You know, the water, there's no force like the force of that water, you know, as it hits. And it can hit the wall of a building with enough strength to just tear the building out, you know, just completely destroy the building just by the force of the way the water hits.
Are you concerned that there will be more destruction from the flood? For instance, has most of the destruction happened when the levees broke?
No. When water stands in buildings for days, as it did, it destroys. You know what happens to anything that sits in water for a while. It just literally dissolves within itself. And we have buildings that have been in water for, you know, days at a time. So there is going to be permanent wood damage. And some of those buildings, if they were in the wake, like, say, of a levee break or something like that, they may have been pushed off their foundation. You know, they may, all of those buildings are going to have to be checked out to make certain that they are safe for people to travel in. There is, even if you have, like, water in your basement, your floor buckles in your house. So, you know, when that water goes away, you have a floor that, you know, well, maybe you replace it, maybe you will deal with the lumps for the rest, you know, for however long you can handle that. And we have a lot of land that has been underwater. There's been a tremendous road destruction. So we don't know, you know, once the water goes away, how many holes there are out there underneath that water. I know in the flood of 73, there were holes along the Missouri River levees in places that they have never been able to fill. Hmm. Those holes still exist. Now, I'm sure they may have gotten filled up with this flood. I mean, it's possible that the water came in and washed enough stuff in to finally fill them up. But they're going to leave a hole someplace else. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's going to be a lot of that. There's going to be some places that will never be repaired. It's better to just tear them down, or, you know, there will. And like the land, too, we don't know. Until this water disappears and we can actually get out there on foot and walk through it, we don't know the extent of the destruction. Mm-hmm. And some of it won't be able to be repaired. Some of it will be minor. You know, it's a little scary that way. It's like I say, we're right in the middle of it right now. We don't know.
Right.
You know, we're still sitting here waiting for the water to just go away. Mm-hmm. You know.
Have you seen evidence that the water is actually receding?
Yeah, it is. It's going down. Yeah, you can see that right away, where it goes down. And even if it comes back again, you can tell how much it has come back because it leaves a different color every time. I mean, you can look at the buildings and you can see, because that moisture, you know, is still in the buildings. It's like in the trees, you know, the bottom of the tree, so many feet up the trunk, you can see where that tree stood in water for a while. And on the ground, the dirt itself is a different color. You know, how it is when it's wet, you know, as dry ground versus wet ground, it leaves a different color. So it's easy to see where it's been. It also tends to leave trash behind, you know, a line of trash. You can go out and look like where the water was to a certain point. It washed all this stuff up, and when it started to go away, it left just a line of dead limbs and trash and garbage and whatever else it washed in that stays there. And then, you know, it slowly washes it back down.
Now, as farmers, you've been through other weather problems, weather crises before. There was the drought of the late 80s, and other times as well. And you say one of the biggest hazards of being a farmer is the stress of not being in control. Is that something that you and your husband and other farmers have to constantly fight up against?
Oh, sure, because you can't control the elements. You can't control Mother Nature, and you can't control the prices, you know. It's a gamble. You put your crops in, or you raise your animals, and you pray that the price will be good whenever it comes time to sell. And, you know, if you have a lot of expenses and you're raising a family, it puts a lot of stress on you, because you know that whether you sell at a decent price or not, you've got bills you're going to have to pay. You know, and you're going to have to somehow manage to get those bills paid.
Are you concerned that farmers like yourself and your husband, small family farmers, will just abandon their farms? They're going to say, this has just been too much?
No. That's the spirit of the farmer. There are some. There are a few who have, you know, who say, I can't deal with it anymore. There are always a few, but the majority of them, no. They will not, because farming is in their blood. They're going to say, we'll dig in and next time we'll know how to deal with it better. You know, it's just, my husband is fourth or fifth generation farmer, and he's not going to leave. He's already working strategy for next year, you know, in ways to figure out how we can almost benefit from what's happened to us this year.
Can you even imagine life off a farm?
No. No, I do not want any other life. Absolutely.
Well, I want to take a very short break, and then I want to talk some more. My guest today is Mary Elizabeth Fricke, and she's a hog farmer and a writer, and we're talking to her from her home in Herman, Missouri, and she's right in the middle of the flood devastation. And the book that she has just written is called Dino, Godzilla, and the Pigs, My Life on Our Missouri Hog Farm. More after a short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is writer and farmer Mary Elizabeth Fricke. When you married your husband, Dennis Fricke, what did you imagine farm life would be like?
Quiet. I'm kind of a quiet person. I like my peace and my privacy. I never imagined that I would be driving a tractor. I knew that I would be chasing hogs. I mean, I did that as a kid, and I knew that there are times, you know, but I didn't expect to do it on a daily basis. And driving the equipment is something, and as it said in the book, it took me a long time to get to where I could drive the combine. I still can't drive the big farm trucks because I've never learned to properly handle a standard shift, you know, so I can't do any of the hauling or anything like that. But I don't know. It's a quiet, peaceful life, you know, for the most part. And I guess that's what I saw more than anything. Remembering, you know, when I was a child and we lived, you know, in the bluff right above the river, you know, it was really a secluded place. And I remembered from that the quiet life that we had then. And I guess that's what I expected this would be.
Well, tell us when you first started working with your husband, what your first real job was. What first responsibility he gave you?
Oh, I was to learn how to give the shots and to trim the teeth and tails on the piggies.
Do you get attached to your hogs?
No. No, we you can. I mean, it's possible. We have had a few in the area that we felt special to, but usually they're not really here long enough to distinguish, you know. As soon as they reach their selling weight, they're gone, and there are so many of them that every now and then there's one or two that kind of catches your eye and hangs and you know becomes a little special, but not like I do my puppy dogs.
Well, I was going to say there must be a difference between barn animals and house pets.
Yeah, there is. I mean, dogs, pigs rather do have personalities. They do have facial expressions. And they are not dumb. They are extremely intelligent animals. Their main flaw is the fact that they're stubborn. You know, they're just really bullheaded, and they're like, they want to do what they want to do. And if they have a place where they want to be, you're not going to run them out of that place unless they let you. You know, they're really bullheaded creatures, but they're not dumb.
Now, how many hogs do you have?
Well, at this point, oh, my. We maintain somewhere between 1,500 and 2,000 in a year's time.
Now, were they affected by the flood at all, or?
No. No, we live far enough away that they weren't. The only effect that we have had is that the place where we loaded the hogs to take them in to sell was flooded. And it will be quite some time before it's repaired enough that we can sell them there. So we have to go several miles in another direction.
Let me just shift gears here slightly and talk a little bit about your writing. How do you find time to write when you're farming?
I write at night.
Every night?
Basically, yeah. as often as possible. Sometimes it may be 7 days a week, and then I might skip two or three. In the spring and the fall, it's less. If, you know, when Dennis needs me out in the field 10, 12 hours a day, you know, obviously I'm too exhausted to write at night. But then I usually have something handy that I can edit or some research or something that I can do, and I take that along with me. And if I have time during the day, I try to work on that out there.
Out there meaning out in the field?
Yeah, on the edge of the field. I usually have a little bit of time where I have to sit and wait for him for one reason or another. Or sometimes, you know, I just need to rest. And, like, writing to me is breathing. You know, it's like taking a long, slow breath sometimes.
Well, I'd like to have you read a section from your book. It's a description. Well, why don't you read it for us?
A 10-acre field at the base of the valley separates us from Dennis' parents' home. Other houses far and near dot the hillsides. There is a packing house about a mile down the road that draws a good deal of traffic during the day, but for the most part it is quiet here. The only sounds to be heard most of the time are the humming of the farm machinery in the distance, the lowing of cattle, and the protesting squeal of a hog as our 1,500 herd shifts itself into new alignment. I can tell the sound of my husband's pickup truck, or my father-in-law's, or either the farm trucks when they start up. I know without looking which tractor is being used and when my husband is grinding feed. I can hear the school bus a mile away, and I know the sound of the feed truck when it comes to make a delivery. On summer evenings, the whippoorwills and the katydids among the trees serenade us. Toward daybreak, I am often awake by the yipe of coyotes and the neighborhood dogs answering howl. We sometimes hear a screech owl nearby, though we have not heard one recently. After dark, we often sit in the yard barbecuing a late supper, and as we watch the fireflies under the stars, not a car passes.
I'm curious how the flood has changed the sounds that you hear. A passage from your book really describes the sounds of farm life, and with the flood, how does it sound different?
Well, it's a lot quieter. I think the thing that part of our farmland that went under, I know when we went out there, there was absolute stone silence. I mean, you don't hear the frogs creaking anymore. You don't hear the birds singing. You don't hear the animals. You know, usually if you sit quietly, you can hear animals kind of rushing through the woods and everything. The animals are gone at this point. They've gone to higher ground. If they survived, a lot of them haven't survived. And it's, you don't hear the birds. You know, the happy sounds, they're not there anymore. So, and I know this year that we won't be hearing too many grain dryers in the area. We won't be hearing a lot of tractors in the area, you know, big trucks. So one thing that happened that was when Herman was flooded, the road that we live on is about the only road in this area that will connect the two major highways that go into Herman. So they detoured the traffic right past our house. And for a week there, what I wrote in the book was about the opposite of what we were hearing. We could not hardly pull out of our driveway without cars going by. It was just continual traffic up and down our road. And that made it a lot noisier and a lot dustier.
Well, I thank you very much, Mary Elizabeth Fricke, for joining us today on Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Mary Elizabeth Fricke's book is called Dino, Godzilla, and the Pigs. I'm Marty Moskowain, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR, National Public Radio. Thank you.
From Philadelphia, I'm Marty Moscoane with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with film director Bill Duke about why he doesn't want to be typecast as a black film director. He directed the films A Rage in Harlem and Deep Cover, as well as hundreds of television shows. His most recent film, The Cemetery Club, is about three older Jewish widows. And Maureen Carrigan reviews the romantic novel The Bridges of Madison County with the help of Dorothy Parker. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. In Geneva, Bosnian factions have agreed in principle to put Sarajevo under UN control after a peace agreement is reached. This occurred just hours after the three warring parties sat down face-to-face for the first time in 2 weeks. Under the agreement to be completed by committee, the capital would become a virtual open city outside any of the three separate states being worked out in Geneva. Meanwhile, Serbian forces are leaving two key mountain regions outside of Sarajevo 2 weeks after they were seized. In Hawaii, residents there are making storm preparations with a hurricane watch in effect for all of the Hawaiian islands. Craig DeSilva of Hawaii Public Radio reports.
Hurricane Fernanda is playing what weather officials call a cat-and-mouse game. Fernanda has stalled east, northeast of the Big Island, the largest of the Hawaiian island chain. But winds have intensified. Sustained winds are about 105 miles an hour, with gusts up to 125 miles an hour. Weather officials are not predicting what path the hurricane will take, but if it continues with its original course, parallel to the islands, Hawaii should be feeling the outskirts of its strong winds and high surf later today. The eye of the storm is large enough to engulf the entire island of Oahu if the storm moves closer, but even if it stays 100 miles away from the island, torrential rain is expected. Thousands of people on the Big Island near the shoreline are getting ready to evacuate as surf is expected to reach 25 feet. For National Public Radio, I'm Craig DeSilva in Honolulu.
In New York City, AT&T has announced that it will merge with one of the country's leaders in cellular telephones in a $12.6 billion agreement. NPR's Maria Hinojosa reports.
AT&T has taken over Macross Cellular Telecommunications, which is better known as Cellular One, a company based in the state of Washington. While AT&T is a global leader in long-distance telephone service, Cellular One is a pioneer in cellular, paging, and other wireless telecommunications services. This is basically a deal which brings together long-distance lines with wireless communications, and the companies say it will bring more access to the user, where in the future you can expect to have one phone number and one cellular handset that will work anywhere in the country. The deal will boost AT&T into the fastest developing telecommunications market, the international cellular phone business, while Macross Communications gets to market their products through the AT&T network. The deal is still subject to approval by the FCC, the Department of Justice, and other state regulatory authorities. In New York, this is Maria Hinojosa.
Also in New York on Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up 9.5 points to close at 3,579.15 on volume of more than 229 million shares. Trading was heavy. This is NPR News. 3 days after a hotel collapsed in Thailand, rescue workers found five women still alive in the wreckage. Only hours after officials said that there was no chance of finding any more survivors and started to use bulldozers in the debris, there were signs of life, and five more people were found. Officials say at least 95 people were killed in the collapse of the building 130 miles north of Bangkok. More than 200 people were injured, and up to 60 people are still missing. Two North Carolina teenagers accused of killing the father of basketball star Michael Jordan have been arraigned on charges of first-degree murder, armed robbery, and conspiracy to commit armed robbery. Kevin Marks of member station WFAE reports.
Two 18-year-olds are accused in the death of 56-year-old James Jordan. Larry Demery told a Robeson County, North Carolina judge this morning that he has an attorney while Daniel Green will be represented by the Public Defender's Office. Both are being held without bond, with the probable case hearing set for September 3rd. Authorities say Demery and Green shot and robbed James Jordan on July 23rd after he stopped to rest on his way back to his Charlotte area home. They then allegedly dumped his body in a South Carolina creek. It was identified last Friday as Jordan's. Officials say a cellular phone taken from Jordan's car helped lead to the arrests. Demery's attorney says it will be difficult to get a fair trial due to the publicity surrounding the case. For National Public Radio, I'm Kevin Marks reporting.
According to U.S. naval officials, a Chinese freighter believed to be trying to smuggle chemical weapons materials to Iran is now out of Iranian waters. For nearly 2 weeks now, U.S. warships have been following the freighter. A request to inspect the ship's cargo has been denied by China, along with charges it is carrying any illegal cargo to Iran. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Bill Duke is a striking figure. He's a 6'4" African-American with a completely shaved head. You might remember him playing opposite Arnold Schwarzenegger in the movies Commando and Predator. Duke makes a convincing bad guy. But more often, he's working on the other side of the camera, directing. His feature films include A Rage in Harlem and Deep Cover. He also spent years in television, directing episodes of Falcon Crest, Hill Street Blues, and Miami Vice. Bill Duke's most recent film may seem like an unlikely choice for him. The Cemetery Club is the story of three middle-aged Jewish women who are widowed and find themselves once again on the dating circuit. These lifelong friends are played by Olympia Dukakis, Ellen Burstyn, and Diane Ladd. I first spoke with Bill Duke last February when the movie came out. It's now available on video. Duke told me that neither he nor any of his leading ladies are Jewish, so to keep things accurate, he had a rabbi on the set at all times.
The irony is that the more research I did and the more I talked to the rabbi, the more I understood that these people were very much like my relatives and my mother and my aunts, that the ceremonies and rituals were a bit different. But fundamentally, we're talking about people that work for a living and raise children and have values and love and believe in friendships. And I think there's a universality about a certain class of people in any culture that basically do that.
As a black director, are you expected to do black movies? Are there pressures on you to do black movies?
Unfortunately, if your face is black in Hollywood, you are relegated, for the most part, to doing films, directing films that have black people in them. Now, there's nothing wrong with that, but we should be allowed to choose the kinds of films and the kinds of genres of films that we wish to direct and be involved in. I am very happy with this particular experience because I was hired based upon my talent and not my ethnicity. And I must compliment the Walt Disney Company and David Hoberman and Bridget Johnson, those people there, because they had the courage to do so. They got a lot of phone calls. You know, once people knew I was directing this film, what the hell is this black guy doing directing this film about Jews? What does he have in common with them?
Where were the phone calls coming from?
Well, from, you know, people in the industry that didn't understand, you know. There were a lot of directors that were up for it that were Jewish, and a lot of women were up there up for it, you know, and they were wondering, what's going on, you know. And Disney and I always responded, what qualified me was my humanity, and if that was very difficult for them to understand, then they would, and they didn't get the joke.
You made your movie directorial debut with A Rage in Harlem.
Well, actually, it was one movie before that.
Oh, what was the movie?
And that was called The Killing Floor, which I directed for PBS. It was about the unionization of the Meatpackers Union in Chicago in the early 1900s.
Okay. You did make, though, A Rage of Harlem at the age of 48, is that right?
Yes.
Did you want to direct movies before then, but never had really been given the opportunity?
Yes. I wanted to direct features, you know, in my 20s. But, you know, it's been a long route for me, kind of like, you know, I've gone around the long way to get back to the short way correctly, I guess you could say. But it's been a long time.
Well, you've made more than 100 television shows.
Mm-hmm.
Was that a detour for you, or is that just a way of getting in the movies? I mean, do you see that as time lost?
No, that's a double-edged sword television,
yeah.
Because it was an extremely wonderful training ground for me, because it enabled me to really have a great familiarity with the camera and work with actors and scripts and editing and pre-production and post-production and all the rest of that, you know, over and over and over again. So I gained a great deal of confidence in my ability to deal with the technical aspect of film through, you know, television. At the same time, however, you can get stuck in television. The money is very, very good, and the residuals are even more wonderful. So you can create I created a lifestyle that I kind of got trapped by and detoured me in terms of, you know, kind of like off of my original goal.
So you really didn't want to take the risk in movies for fear of losing your lifestyle?
Yes, exactly. And my lifestyle was exactly the thing I had to sacrifice in order. I was making a lot more money than I ever thought, yeah, I would make in television, and I was getting these physical ailments, headaches and backaches, and I went to the doctor, and he said, "There's nothing wrong with you."
Oh.
He says, "Why don't you cut down on your work?" And a friend of mine said, "Why don't you just, like, you know, do what you really want to do?" So I gave up. I just stopped directing television, except for maybe three or four or five shows a year. I was doing 12, 13 or so. And believe it or not, all these physical symptoms started to disappear. And I started doing PBS. I directed Lorraine Hansberry's Raisin in the Sun and a thing called The Meeting by Jeff Stetson, about a fictitious meeting between Malcolm X and Martin Luther King. And so those things are things that my heart was attached to. I went back to TV to do, like, movies of the week and, you know, things like pilots I really wanted to do. And once I think my heart was more involved in things, I began to get on track again. And then that's when I got my first feature, because a couple of feature producers saw my PBS work.
Well, I want to talk some more, but first we just have to take a very short break. Let me reintroduce you. My guest is director Bill Duke. He's made a number of movies, including A Rage in Harlem, and he was also... I'm looking here. Also did Deep Cover with Larry Fishburne and Jeff Goldblum, and has appeared in a number of movies himself. We'll be talking a little bit more after a short break. This is Fresh Air. I'm speaking with director Bill Duke. Now, my understanding is that your parents wanted you to be pre-med. Is that right?
Yes, and I very foolishly took some courses in which I failed miserably, you know, consecutively lower grades three separate times. So I kind of got the message that maybe that wasn't it. But I always saw this gleam in the eye of these people cutting up dogs and cats and, you know, sand sharks, and I thought they were a little mad, you know. And then they said, well, you know, because my mother and father only went to attended the second and third grade, and they had to work, you know. So education, the first kid in their family to go to college, was a mm-hmm. big deal. So you had to be something practical to make money and not have to go through the things they went through.
So how did you tell them that you weren't interested in this pre-med?
Well, my grades were so bad, I think they obviously kind of caught on to that and they understood. So they said, well, the next best thing, since you want to be in the arts, well, you know, so be an English teacher. That's close enough. You write all the time. So if you're a teacher, you can always fall back on that. And I went to BU, and I had fallen asleep for the third time in my Chaucer class, and the teacher asked me to leave. And a friend who was my roommate, Israel Hicks, he said, you know, Bill, you've been talking about acting and writing for a long time. I got a friend, Lloyd Richards, who was a teacher over here in the School of the Arts. Why don't you audition? I said, I have nothing to lose, so I did. And I got in. And that next semester, you know, the gleam that I had seen in my classmates' eyes cutting up those dogs was in my eye. It was like coming home, you know. I was coming home to a feeling of, like, you know, I belonged. I was always, like, I felt weird outside of this environment.
You mentioned the fact that your parents really didn't even complete elementary school. Where did you live, and what kinds of jobs did they have? What was your childhood like?
Well, my childhood was both horrible and wonderful. I mean, I guess like everybody's is horrible and wonderful, but my images of my father was a man who was determined to take his family out of a relatively ghetto situation. So he actually, literally, believe it or not, got five jobs simultaneously from time to time.
He was working five jobs?
He would go into the foundry and work from 12 until 8 in the morning, and then he'd come from the foundry and he would go on the bread route. In those days, we had, you know, we delivered bread, and he'd work on the bread route for a couple of hours, and then he would go blacktopping, and that is, you know, you have these steamrollers that repair potholes in the street, and he would be working the steamroller, and he would work on that for a while. Then he'd come home, and my mother would fix his lunch, dinner, so to speak, and she put this big board across this sitting chair he used to have, and my memories of my father are always with a half-finished meal in front of him, and he'd just fall asleep, you know, and never finish. You know, I don't think my father ever finished a meal in his life until he was much older.
So you never saw much of your father then growing up?
Not very much at all. And then on the weekends, the only time I would see him, and we were working, we would dig dry wells, which were like, you know, these ditches that were 6 to 8 feet deep and 3 to 4 feet wide that would be filled with stone. And then when it rained, the gutter would lead into this ditch, and it would disperse the water evenly throughout a lawn so that it wouldn't back up and to the foundation and erode the foundation of the houses. And then we on the Sunday, my sister, my mother, and my father and I would clean bowling alleys, and you know, so that was my childhood on that level. Then the other side of it was when we were very poor, which was almost a better time for us. We couldn't afford to go to the films, and I loved movies when I was a little kid, but my father felt bad about that, so he used to take us down to Main Street, Poughkeepsie, New York, and he'd make my mother pop a bag of popcorn, and we would sit in our car. And his way of making the movies for us would be, we watch people, and he would say, "What do you think that guy does?" You know, we say, "What do you mean?" And he would say, "Well, look at the shoes, how his shoes are worn on the sides, and look at the coat he's wearing, and you know, how old is, you know, how much money do you think he makes?" And so, you know, it was a game we played that not until much later that I understood, you know, was shaping me into an actor and a filmmaker, which are really observers of people and reporters of people's behaviors.
Were your parents ever bitter at all about the condition of their lives?
Yes, I think they were very angry. You know, my father, you know, to a certain extent, I would say, was a racist. You know, I think my father and mother have seen, my father's deceased now, my mother's still living, but I think they'd both come from the South. My father's from Orange, Virginia. My mother's was from West Point, Mississippi. My father came to Poughkeepsie very early, and you know, they in the South in those days, you know, this is before Dr. King, you know, and my mother tells stories of some of the things that she's seen that happened to relatives and friends that I think, you know, they're kind of permanent scars. And to their credit, you know, I don't think they hate anybody, but I think that they have been scarred by those experiences.
Did they make remarks? I mean, you said you thought your parents were racist. Did they make remarks?
Not my parents, my father more than
your
anything.
Father more. But would he say things?
Yes, yeah, he would say things. He would say, he would say things out of pain. You know, he would say things that reflected his experience in this country, trying to be a man and try to raise his family and being discriminated against in the way that he was. You know, he was, because he had no education, he was at the bottom of the barrel of a lot of things. But he was a brilliant man. He was a very creative person. And I think that was a great torture for him.
Let me ask you about another part of your career. You first got into theater just by acting. How did you get then from acting to directing? What was the transition there?
Well, I started out as a stage director and couldn't get arrested. You know, I just couldn't survive. You know, I was working in New York, directing my own plays and plays for other people, and I never made over $3,000 a year, you know, just an unemployment and the rest of it, and just going downhill. And so I started acting, and that helped. I was in a Broadway play for like a year, but I still wanted to direct. But the equipment of film was very intimidating to me. And so I went away to BU and got into, you know, theater courses, and then came back to New York again, and then came out to California. And I was in a a series on television for 2 seasons called Palmerstown USA. And I thought I was gonna, you know, I'd made it. I was co-starring in it, and then the series ended, and I didn't work for 2 years. And then I made a 45-minute short called The Hero, which won some awards, and I tried to shop it around to studios for a couple of years. No one would buy it, or no one would hire me as director. And then I was at a meditation retreat in Calistoga, and I was meditating, and my agent called me, and he said, they want you to do a Knots Landing. I thought, I couldn't believe it. And so I came back, and I met the producer, David Jacobs. He says, I want you to do this, you know, this project. And so I was prepping. My first Knots Landing, I was prepping. And the last day of prep, which was the seventh day, Joe Wallenstein, the producer, called me into his office, and he said, you know, I like your prep and your good luck tomorrow, but I could tell you're going to be great from your reel. I said, what are you talking about? I said, I don't have a reel. He says, what are you talking about? I said, all I have is a short film from AFI. So he runs out of the office, and he comes back, and what had happened was they had mixed my film up with a reel from a director, and they wanted to fire me on the spot. But it was the last day of prep, and they couldn't. And so I went through and directed the Knots Landing, and then they gave me a second one, and that's how my career started.
Well, I thank you very much, Bill Duke, for joining us today. I really appreciate your time.
This is very pleasant, and I really appreciate it.
Director Bill Duke, his latest film, The Cemetery Club, is now out on video. This is Fresh Air. All Things Considered is coming up. Linda Wertheimer has joined us to tell us about the show today. Linda, what stories will you be covering?
Marty, we're going to start out with the president and health care reform. He is speaking to the governors at their meeting in Oklahoma today. The Secretary of Housing is also talking about what the Clinton administration hopes to do with public housing and who needs it and how long people should be able to use it. We'll be talking to a parish priest about how he relates what the Pope said in the Pope's visit to his own parishioners. We'll have a little bit of a review of the BCCI scandal. AT&T has bought a big cell phone company, and we'll talk to a bubblegum champ.
Thanks, Linda. Those stories and more later today on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Today, the Doonesbury comic strip launched an assault on one of this year's most surprising literary success stories, The Bridges of Madison County by Robert James Waller. Critic Maureen Corrigan says it may take more than a comic strip to blow this book out of the water. She suggests pitting this literary phenom of 1993 against the popular critic of the 20s and 30s, Dorothy Parker. Parker would have been 100 on Sunday, but Maureen says age hasn't dulled her sharp wit.
Last week at a party, I was surrounded by body-snatching aliens who looked like my former literature-loving friends. They were all clutching copies of that pretentious and contagious pulp, The Bridges of Madison County. "Read it," the aliens chanted. "You'll cry." To placate them, I began reading. On page 3 of the novel, the hero, Robert Kincaid, wishes for a dog to keep him company. On page 6, in the exact same language, he wishes for a woman. I snorted, and the aliens looked worried. By the time I got to the end of this male romance fantasy and read how the heroine, Francesca, always remembered Robert as a leopard-like creature who rode into her life on the tail of a comet, I was making rude gagging noises. Meanwhile, the aliens around me were dematerializing into red dust. One managed to choke out a question. "How did you resist?" "Easy," I told the space invader. "I vaccinated myself with doses of Dorothy Parker." Lately, I've been rereading Parker and remembering how much she meant to me. She was an all-too-rare literary dream model of a woman who was smart, funny, beautiful, and sophisticated. She was also self-destructive, 4 suicide attempts, alcoholism, and a chronic lack of discipline. I was reminded of Parker's problems in a brutal but very smart article by Joan Acacella in last week's New Yorker. Acacella laments that the depressive Parker limited herself in her famous book reviews to easy marks like etiquette books and high society novels. Granted, Parker should have taken more swats at literary heavyweights, but what she did do so brilliantly in those flip reviews was to expose the manipulations and fantasies in the bad but popular literature that none of her peers bothered with. Acacella says if Parker were around today, she'd be flattening Danielle Steele. I'd like to pit her against Robert Waller. Literary piffle masquerading as high art always made Parker lick her lips in anticipation of a juicy kill. In her 1927 demolition job of a book entitled Happiness, which, like Bridges, was very slim, Parker writes, "Happiness is second only to a rubber duck as the ideal bathroom companion. It may be held in the hand without causing muscular fatigue. It may be read through before the water has cooled. And if it slips down the drainpipe, all right, it slips down the drainpipe." In a rare 50s review, Parker complained about the leadenness of Jack Kerouac's characters in The Subterraneans. She might have been describing the dialogue in Bridges between Robert and Francesca. They speak, she says, mainly to tell one another how great they are. But maybe Parker's last post-mortem word on Bridges should be a poetic consolation to Francesca, assuring her she made the right decision in not eloping with Robert. Here's Parker's poem, Unfortunate Coincidence. By the time you swear you're his, shivering and sighing, and he vows his passion is infinite, undying, lady, make a note of this, one of you is lying. Parker's chronic cynicism may have narrowed her life and her writing, but it also gave her a liberating immunity against the seductions of the second rate.
Maureen Corrigan teaches at Georgetown University. Fresh Air's senior producer this week is Fred Landrell. Our technical director is Joyce Lieberman. Our engineers this week are Ron Barron, Richard Parker, and Joyce Lieberman again. Dorothy Fireby is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. I'm Marty Moscowain.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by this and other NPR member stations. Additional support comes from the George Gund Foundation. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Children's book illustrator Ted Lewin loves two things, pro wrestling and painting. On the next Fresh Air, Lewin tells us how he worked his way through art school in the 1950s by working as a pro wrestler. Lewin has written and illustrated an evocative new memoir about wrestling life. I'm Marty Moscowain, and I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.